telling Syria's war stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Rami Jara braves the war-torn streets of Aleppo to tell the stories of people there, like a Syrian wife who asked her husband not to fight.
He grabbed her and shook her and said, "I have to do this. We have to do this for the family."
Plus, a volunteer who helps Syrian refugees in Greece is now in Flint, Michigan.
Similarities are pretty striking. I mean, you know, they may almost resemble internally displaced peoples within their own country. How can this be happening in the United States?
And a vet used to treating pets with Gucci collars gets an offer to help save iguanas in Haiti.
And then I received an email inviting me to come here to work in this community where there's no electricity. And so I did.
Those stories coming up today on The World. Thanks for being here today. How to tell the story of the Syrians who remain inside Syria. It's obviously a big problem in the coverage, given how few independent Western journalists are able to get into Syria. There isn't a single one in the northern city of Aleppo right now. But we did manage to get some compelling stories out of there today, as you'll hear in just a moment. First, though, a little background. This week, Syrian government forces unleashed a major bombing campaign in Aleppo. Russian warplanes helped from the air. Together, they cut off a key rebel supply route into the city, which means it's hard for civilians now to get out. Syrian-British activist Rami Jara was in Aleppo recently and is now back at his base in Istanbul. Jara is with the citizen media project ANA Press, and he's constantly in touch with people still inside Aleppo.
There's only now a very narrow road that will allow anyone to get in and out of the city, and that road is now constantly under attack. What we saw today, in particular in central Aleppo, were a number of attacks on local markets, one of which was the market that I was staying just by. I was actually just watching some of the content that's just been coming out, and it's just horrendous. The government is now trying to totally desert the city and block off any roads at the same time to prevent people coming in and out of those areas towards Turkey. Aleppo is now becoming an example of what we saw in other places of the country, but on a much smaller scale. This is a city that has over 500,000 people in it, and they're now basically under siege.
So I'd like you to tell us about a few of the people you got to know during this recent trip to Aleppo, and we'll have your portraits of them, really striking portraits at PRI.org. Tell us first about a woman who is a part-time fighter. She gave you her name as Abdo, or Mother of Abdo, the name of her oldest son. Tell us first about the photo you took of her.
Abdo is basically a widow to a man who would fight in the Free Syrian Army. She explained to me that she used to always beg him not to go out and fight. And then at one time, he grabbed her and shook her when she was telling him he couldn't leave and said, "I have to do this. We have to do this for the family." One day, her husband didn't come back, and she was left to take care of the children. Mm. And she then understood, once he was gone, why he was doing this, as she saw her neighbors lose their men and lose their children, and she saw her friends die. So she joined a group and began fighting against the regime. And what was shocking to me about this woman was how much energy she had. She was able to, in the morning, take her children to one of the local schools that was in a banged-up flat, and then she would go on a bus and head to the northern areas of Aleppo to fight on fronts against ISIS. This woman was amazing.
Is it not frowned on in Syria for a woman to pick up a gun and go to war?
It's actually not. The war has sort of imposed this situation where it's mainly men who are fighting. So women seem to have less of a role in society. And that does sort of mean less respect in general, whether it's from children or sort of any element in society. But I think that's what encourages some women that are very strong-hearted and very strong, a sense of that, no, I want to be part of this. I want to have a say. I think she's one of those women that believes that she has a voice. And this is the way that she was expressing herself.
Yeah, I mean, the photo you took of her seated there in her hijab with her, what looks like an AK-47 next to her, she's in it to win it.
Yeah, yes.
Finally, there's this picture you took of an elderly gentleman named Dored, whom you got to know. What were the circumstances of his life when you met him?
I was in the local market, an area called Sukkari, and we'd heard an airstrike just being carried out. It was very close because it shook the whole area we were in. And then after climbing the debris and seeing a number of people that had lost loved ones and were screaming, and in a moment like that, when it's very intense, people are usually dragged to scenes of the bloody scenes where there's a body on the floor. There are people trying to pull people out from under the rubble. And there was this one house that you could see the whole wall had been blown into the house. And I looked into the house and I saw this old man standing in the back of the room, and he was covered in debris. And I apologized, but someone told me, don't worry, if you want to speak to him, you can go in, it's fine. And he explained to me that this man had been in prison for many years, over 20 years, in Assad's dungeons. And this was because he was a political prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been released during the uprising. But once he'd come out, his family, his children, all those that he knew before he went to prison had gone, and he'd found no sign of them. I started speaking to him, and I asked if I could take pictures, and he sort of quietly nodded. I began taking pictures of him, and he said to me, why are you taking these pictures, son? I said to him, I want to show this to everyone else out, you know, everyone else in the world. I want people to see this. And he said, be careful that you show it to the right people, because there are many people that hate us, and whatever you give them, they'll use it against us. But when I posted this picture, there was this young lady from Spain who actually contacted me. And she said she was very moved by his story. And she asked me if I could get a letter to him. So she wrote this letter to me. And what this letter said was, you're not on your own in this world. There is someone on the other side of the world who cares for you and is praying that God keeps you safe. Her name was Fabiola. So I took this letter and I wrote it on a piece of paper myself in Arabic and in English. And I went back to this man's house. I told him, I know this isn't much, but this is a letter that someone asked me to give you. So he read the letter. And as he read it, he basically began to weep. And he said, tell Fabiola, I know that there are good people out there. And that was in response to when he said, show it to the right people. And I asked him, your family, you don't want to know where they are? And he said, if they were alive, I would obviously have found them. And this makes sense. In every household, you have either a child or a woman or a man that is missing. When I say there are 500,000 people in Aleppo right now, that number isn't precise. And I sometimes don't believe it, because I sometimes see the same faces every day when I walk in the street. I see the same faces again and again and again. And it scares me that the numbers might be much smaller than that.
Rami, did you ever think you would leave Syria and then go back?
I have a daughter. I don't think I could make her live in a situation like that and not feel guilty. But there is an obligation. And there are people that still live in this city that are unable to leave this city, because they don't want to be humiliated and crossing borders and being beaten up by soldiers and then dragged across the sea and possibly drowning. And it's important that the people that are still there have a voice, rather than us just talking about the peace talks right now, because these attacks are pure proof that these peace talks are not real.
Will you go back, and would you try and take a Western journalist with you?
I will go back, yes. We're trying to figure out a route back in now, because it's almost totally blocked off. I hope that, and I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, standing above and talking down, but I know a lot of journalists, Western journalists, who are very, very intent on getting word out on the stories that they care about or that they cover. I just hope that there are people that are willing now to go into a situation like this and cover this war. But it seems like many journalists have lost that faith in telling this story.
Syrian British journalist and activist Rami Jara recently returned from Aleppo in Syria. He's with the citizen media project ANA Press. Rami, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you for having me.
3.5 years ago, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange walked into the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and he has not left since. Assange took refuge inside the embassy to avoid an extradition request from Sweden, where he's wanted for questioning over rape allegations. Today, an interesting twist to the story, a United Nations committee has reportedly ruled that Assange's voluntary stay at the embassy constitutes arbitrary detention. Esther Adley has been reporting on this case for The Guardian these 3+ years. I asked her what the ruling means.
It's not a legally binding ruling that this committee has come up with, but it is the UN Committee on Arbitrary detention, their working group. We haven't seen the findings yet. They will be published Friday morning in Geneva time. But as far as we are aware, the Swedish have confirmed today that they have concluded that Assange was arbitrarily detained. Now, quite what that means, we will wait and see. But essentially, you're right. Assange did voluntarily enter the embassy, but his argument was that he had no option.
So this UN working group on arbitrary detention, why'd they take up Assange's case?
He made a submission to them. In the past, they've looked at a number of international figures, including Aung San Suu Kyi was a case that they looked at. And they declined to take a view on Saddam Hussein's detention. But they did eventually say that Tariq Aziz, his former minister, had been arbitrarily detained. So they do have form in making judgments on cases of individuals on a sort of human rights basis.
Did you just say that it was Assange himself who brought his case up with the UN?
So I understand, yes, it was a submission made by Assange and his legal team that they put forward in 2014.
That's kind of weird because that would imply that he doesn't want to be there anymore. Why doesn't he just walk out on his own the same way he walked in?
Well, he doesn't want to walk out because as far as Assange and his legal team are concerned, this is part of a much bigger picture. He says that he wants to answer the allegations of rape and he wants to clear his name. But what he says is that the US are still seeking his potentially seeking his extradition. Now, we don't know that that is the case, but we do understand that there has been a secret grand jury impaneled looking into WikiLeaks and Julian Assange over the cable releases which were published some years ago. And the Assange legal team certainly believe that the US may seek Assange's extradition. So from their point of view, even if Sweden were to drop this case altogether, they don't necessarily feel that he would be at liberty to walk out of the embassy tomorrow because they feel he might suddenly be arrested by the British on behalf of the US, who are then seeking his extradition separately.
Right. Practically speaking, though, how would this work if the UN announces tomorrow he's been arbitrarily detained? Like, he would get some special escort to the airport and fly back to Sweden and answer those charges so he would not be detained by British police?
First of all, important to note that these findings don't have any legal force. They are advisory. They've been used in the past to sort of apply pressure on states, and it would certainly add a lot of moral force, I think, to Assange's arguments, but it doesn't have any legal force, and neither the British government nor the Swedish would be compelled to take any action as a result of it. And it's fair to say that both governments, while they haven't yet responded formally, both have indicated that they don't really accept the report's findings if this is indeed what they have found.
So what could happen tomorrow if the UN says he's been arbitrarily detained? Kind of nothing?
Well, Assange put out a tweet overnight which grabbed a lot of people's attention, and he said, if the UN panel finds against me, I will walk out of the embassy on Friday. I will hand myself over to British police and I will allow myself to be arrested because all avenues have come to an end. But, he says, if they find in my favour, I expect my passport to be returned to me and I expect the threat of arrest to be lifted. In fact, if, as we expect, it has found in his favour, he won't probably, in all likelihood, emerge from the embassy. If Assange ever does get to the stage where those conditions are met to his satisfaction and he feels secure enough to leave the embassy, I expect we wouldn't be too surprised to see him on a plane to Ecuador at some point. But he doesn't at this point have a passport because he was on bail when he entered the embassy. So he first needs to have his passport returned to him by the British authorities.
Mm. It does look like a cramped little embassy. And I got to say, Assange looks like he's put on a little weight. Do you know what his exercise has been there?
I don't know that for a fact. We sort of get little bits of information here and there that he is a treadmill and that he certainly tries to keep himself as healthy as possible. But there have been questions over his health recently. Of course, it's taking a toll on his health 3.5 years inside the embassy.
If it were me, I'd be gaining weight from all the takeout across the street at Harrods.
He's right next to Harrods, so it's a very luxurious part of London to find yourself trapped in. Not that that's much consolation, I imagine.
Esther Hadley reporting on Julian Assange for The Guardian, speaking with me from London. Thanks very much, Esther.
Pleasure.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. For all the talk about the Zika virus and its connection with microcephaly, one thing is missing: definitive proof of a link between the two. Scientists need time for something like that. In a moment, we'll hear just what researchers in Brazil are doing to see if there is indeed a link. But first, a closer look at the numbers of babies born with microcephaly in Brazil, and news that those numbers may be going down. Will Carlos is with our Global Post team. He traveled to Recife in Brazil's northeast, which is the epicenter of the outbreak, and he was surprised by what doctors there told him.
So I came up here to really kind of see this crisis with my own eyes and get into the hospitals here and talk to doctors. And the first thing that I found really interesting was when I started talking to doctors at one of the main hospitals where these children with microcephaly are being referred, they told me, hey, you know, this actually kind of peaked a few weeks ago and has since gone down significantly. I did not know that. I mean, prior to coming here, I think, along with most people out there, believe that this was a crisis that was just kind of getting bigger and bigger. And certainly the numbers in Pernambuco, where I am, which is considered really the epicenter of this whole thing, show that this really saw a peak several weeks ago, back in November, a couple of months ago, and has since dropped off significantly.
So the attitude of those doctors you met at the hospital, they were very much like the crisis is actually past. Did they go that far?
They didn't go that far. They said, in fact, they were the opposite. They said, hey, look, just because we saw a spike a little while ago and that's gone down doesn't mean that this crisis has gone away. In fact, a lady that I just talked to, an expert on this, said that the spike could very well be because that spike came a few months after spike in mosquitoes in this part of the world. You have a wet season here in which there's a lot of mosquitoes, a lot of people get infected with diseases like Zika, and a few months later there are complications in pregnancy. So she's worried that there could be another spike later on this year, sort of a few months after the rainy season when everybody's getting infected with Zika, with other diseases, which is right now in Recife.
So there was this increase in numbers and then a sudden drop. Apparently, the doctors told you that there were a lot of false positives. What threw the doctors off?
Exactly. So I think, you know, hindsight's 20/20. And I think as we go back and we start looking through these numbers, so what the doctors told me was in October 2015, the government put out this bulletin basically saying, we really need you to tell us when a child comes in or when a mother who's pregnant comes in and the baby is showing signs of microcephaly. Right after that, the numbers really spiked up. So I think in November, there were more than 190 cases in 1 week in November. In this last week, there are only 34 cases. So that shows this real buildup and then this kind of just as steep a drop off as well.
Right. So a lot of fuzziness in the data, Will, that scientists now are trying to sharpen up. How can we trust any data about the number of microcephaly cases?
Well, I think they're getting better at it. I think that the data that we need to trust is the sort of the subset. It's the confirmed cases of microcephaly. And then within that, there's another subset, which is the confirmed cases of microcephaly that have actually been linked to the Zika virus, where we know that the mother had Zika. There are a lot of very smart people trying to figure this out right now. There's a lot of people trying to really solidify this link between Zika and microcephaly. And I think in the coming days or even in the next week, I think we're going to see them kind of pull the trigger and say, we can say definitively that there is a link between these two things. But at the end of the day, we do need to be very careful about just how big this problem is and just how much it's spreading. And that's where the sort of fuzziness, sort of studying that fuzziness and being careful with it becomes important.
Will Carlos there with our Global Post team. So researchers in Brazil are trying to see if there is a definitive connection between Zika and microcephaly. Katie Wirth met up with them. She's also in Recife. Katie's a digital reporting fellow with our WGBH partners at Frontline.
There's no definitive link at this point, but they made some progress in the last week. They tested the spinal fluid of 12 babies for an antibody against the Zika virus. And in fact, they found that antibody in all 12 babies, which advances the possibility of a link between Zika and microcephaly.
So how many more babies do they have to get to kind of find a definitive link?
Well, I think that they will be testing about 28 more cases just this week. But to really be definitive will take a lot more research. They're going to start down that path with a controlled study. They'll be testing normal babies and then also babies with microcephaly whose mothers apparently had Zika during their pregnancy. And so when they do that controlled study, they'll feel more confident in the link.
And does the presence of that Zika antibody in the spinal fluid, is that definitive proof for that one individual that they got microcephaly because of Zika?
What that says is that the baby was infected with Zika. So it's not totally clear that every woman who is infected with Zika during her pregnancy passes that virus into the baby. And so this is evidence that in these babies, the virus was passed into the baby, and the baby got sick with Zika in utero, and then the baby's immune system launched a defense against it, and that the Zika virus not only was circulating in the bloodstream, but it was also in the spinal fluid, which means it had access to the nervous system. And of course, microcephaly is an attack on the nervous system. So it kind of tells us a few different things about the possible link.
What has been the footwork involved in kind of testing these kids with microcephaly? Are the doctors tracking down like every kid born in the last few months with microcephaly they can find?
Yeah, starting in November, the government of Brazil started requiring every doctor who was delivering a baby with suspected microcephaly to report it. And they've all been referred to specialists who can then determine whether it's true microcephaly or not.
So the doctors have been checking spinal fluid. I'm wondering, is there any other piece of evidence they can find that would provide really a slam dunk making the connection between Zika and microcephaly?
I don't really know the answer to that. I mean, even getting the spinal fluid is a huge ordeal. It's not a small task to get spinal fluid from a baby,
yeah.
And it's painful, and it's not something they're going to be doing for every baby. And it's not even really important to the baby. You know, they know they have microcephaly. It's not going to affect how they're treated, whether or not they have Zika virus in them. This is purely to better understand the link so that then there can be better public policy decisions made.
So whether there is a link or not between Zika and microcephaly, are the researchers feeling they're any closer to finding the cause of this recent spike of babies born with microcephaly?
Yeah, you know, I think that with every piece of evidence, they're getting more and more certain about this link. So I've been asking every doctor and public health official that I meet whether they're convinced that there's a link. And we may not know the whole story of what is causing this, whether it's just Zika or if it could be an immune response to many different diseases that they're exposed to. There's lots of hypotheses about it, but it seems that the doctors that I'm talking to here feel fairly confident that Zika does play a role.
Katie Wirth is the Tau Journalism Fellow with our WGBH partners at Frontline. Katie, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Next week, we're sending our Across Women's Lives team down to Brazil for a reporting project in partnership with Frontline. We'll be on the ground with Katie and Will, digging in deep on Zika and its impact on women. But you can follow along with our reporting right now. Katie is taking pictures on Instagram from Recife using the hashtag ZikaStories. And you can find us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/AcrossWomen'sLives. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. A young Pakistani woman has a dream to explore her entire country on two wheels.
You can feel the air, the sand, and you're literally going through each and every experience, both physical, mental, and spiritual. So I encourage everybody to adopt motorcycle as a travel buddy.
Motorcycle Diaries Pakistan. That story's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Sometimes two stories on opposite sides of the world strangely converge. The example I'm going to share with you now has to do with two humanitarian crises, one in Europe and one here in the U.S. The one here involves Flint, Michigan, and the people there who can't use their tap water because it's so contaminated with lead, a horrible result of a bad decision in 2014 to swap water supplies to save money. Our friend Jean Carstensen went to Flint to report on that crisis for us, but she also went there to meet someone she met while reporting on another humanitarian crisis thousands of miles away. I'll let Jean take it from here.
I first met Abdullah Shaki last fall on the Greek island of Lesbos in the midst of the refugee crisis.
And he starts telling me that I sold everything I have so that I could afford to pay a smuggler.
I was in Greece reporting, and Abdullah, who was born in California to Egyptian parents, was there helping refugees as part of a team from Islamic Relief USA. A few months later, we're both back in the States, and Abdullah is now leading an Islamic Relief team in Flint, Michigan. He's helping residents cope with the city's water crisis.
We're going to go distribute water at these other complexes, right?
Yes.
Islamic Relief USA is an official partner of the Red Cross, so Abdullah and the team meet at the Red Cross office in Flint to plan for the weekend's water distribution. The city's nearly 100,000 residents have to use filtered or bottled water. Their tap water is contaminated with dangerous levels of lead.
May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala give me, give you, all of us the ability to share, to support. What race, what ethnicity, what color. There's a community in Flint that needs help. It's our community. They're going through a water crisis. Who's going to support?
It's Friday, and Imam Muhammad Abdullah Wahid is giving his weekly sermon at the Flint Islamic Center in the suburbs. The topic is why his Muslim community should help the people in Flint, and Abdullah hopes to recruit lots of volunteers here.
Please join us this weekend, inshallah, helping to distribute water to your neighbors here in Flint.
As Abdullah works the crowd, Imam Wahid tells me that most of the 1,500 or so Muslims around Flint live in the suburbs and haven't been affected by the water crisis. But he's adamant they should help.
As Muslims, we are taught by our prophet and our tradition that we need to serve everyone, you know, irrespective of what ethnicity or religion.
The next morning, the Islamic Relief team and about 25 volunteers unload heavy pallets of water at a public housing complex in North Flint. It's a very depressed part of the city. They head inside with water and filters and start knocking on doors.
Thank you. Volunteers of water. Hi, how you doing? We have cases of water for you today.
I chat with a few residents in the hallway. The tap water is dangerous. But the solution so far, using bottled water, is hard to manage.
So you have to bathe using those small bottles of water?
I have to put them in the sink, you know, and just like doing a baby. When you first have a newborn baby, and you have to do the baby in the sink. Yeah, that's what it seems like. It's like I'm reliving the baby's life all over again.
Later, another Flint resident tells me how angry she is.
When you get a case of bottled water per household, and you have to drink on that water, cook on that water, wipe your kids' face with that water. It's not working. You shouldn't have to live like that. We're not a third world country. We're America. We're the strongest country in the land. Let them tell it.
So far, Islamic Relief has distributed 2 semis full of water. That's 1 case each for 3,000 households. FEMA, the Red Cross, and many others are also helping. About 30,000 households need water every day. Even though the city switched back to the Detroit water system in October, recent test results still show unhealthy lead levels in many homes. And it's not clear how long it will be until the drinking water is safe again.
It's safe to say that no one probably needs water here.
On Sunday, Abdullah and the team drive to another housing complex to deliver water, only to find the empty corpse of a building.
I mean, you want to go knock on some boarded up doors? It's abandoned for sure.
Much of North Flint consists of half-empty blocks with burned-out, boarded-up, or very dilapidated housing. Abdullah keeps driving.
It literally looks like a war zone out here in some places, with houses that have been abandoned, that have been gutted. There are certain blocks that are so run down, they almost resemble pictures out of Syrian neighborhoods sometimes.
We start talking about the Syrians on Lesbos again, where Abdullah and I met. We saw thousands of refugees forced to leave home and seek safety elsewhere. Now in Flint, we see people who are also seeking safety, but it's inside their own homes.
I mean, the similarities are pretty striking. I mean, you know, they may almost resemble internally displaced peoples within their own country. How can this be happening in the United States?
For The World, Jean Carstensen, Flint, Michigan.
A couple of stories now about the hog. I'm talking motorcycles. One of these stories is worrying, the second is uplifting. That first one is set in eastern Ukraine. A fragile ceasefire is in effect there, putting the war between Russian-backed rebels and Western-backed government forces on hold for now. But tensions remain high. That did not deter a group of ultra-nationalist Russians, though, from moving into the region. They're members of a biker gang with ties to the Kremlin called the Night Wolves. Journalist Jack Losh went to meet them at their base in rebel-controlled Ukraine.
They combine fierce patriotism and pro-Putinism. Orthodox Christianity, for sure, is very strong to them. They've got quite an intense industrial Mad Max aesthetic as well.
What do you mean? What does that look like, actually?
For example, you go to the base, it's huge, rusting gates at the entrance, spent artillery shells kind of decorating the place, blown up tanks salvaged from the battlefield in eastern Ukraine, that kind of vibe. And they've gone full circle from starting out as this gang on the fringe who used to party to Western rock music to basically becoming part of the Putin show. For sure, one of the weirder episodes of the Putin show, but they're very much there to spread the gospel for him.
Even before this expedition to Eastern Ukraine, what had been their relationship with Vladimir Putin? How did they become part of the Putin show?
Well, the founder of the Night Wolves is a chap called the Surgeon, Chirurg. In Russian, the surgeon. Mm-hmm. And he's not really
a surgeon, though, is he?
Well, actually, he trained as a dentist, but I guess calling yourself the surgeon is a bit more scary than calling yourself the dentist. So he's developed close links to the Kremlin. And Alex Navalny, the opposition activist, has uncovered a flow of millions of rubles going from the Kremlin, sanctioned by Putin, to the Night Wolves.
So what are they going to be doing exactly in eastern Ukraine?
Well, the Night Wolves have chapters all over Eastern Europe, but this marked a very significant change for the Night Wolves as an organization, where they shifted from, let's say, a tool for exerting soft power, for spreading patriotic fervor, to something a lot harder, to something a lot more violent. And the bikers there actually took up arms. You know, these weren't just some kind of marginals cheering from the sidelines. They were very much there. And certainly the Night Wolves that we met in Luhansk, many of them had fought on the front line. Some of them had been killed, and the guys that we met had probably killed Ukrainian troops as well.
So, Jack, you got close to one leader of the Night Wolves, a guy named Dennis. What was his story?
Well, Marco, his story was very interesting. When I headed into Luhansk with my fellow filmmaker, Sebastian Rabas, he was one of the guys we met very early on. He lives on the base. He's kind of got a guerrilla easy rider look, I guess is the way I'd describe it, kind of leather jacket or the biker paraphernalia, but also wearing an olive green beret with a badge of the hammer and sickle. Mm. He was from Moscow originally, but when the war broke out in eastern Ukraine, he felt it was his duty to go out there and support the Russian-backed insurgency there. And he left his wife and he left his kids, and he told us that every day they Skype at each other, but very, very hard. And it kind of tore his family apart. He felt that he was returning a lost Russian land to Russia.
Do the Night Wolves realize that the idea of a biker gang in leather jackets is originally an American idea? Does Putin, who is into photo ops with the Night Wolves, does he know? Does he care?
No, for sure. That's a very good point. It is a big paradox. On the one hand, they're anti-American. On the other hand, like a big piece of their inspiration seems to come from American biker gang culture. Going back to Dennis again, he told me himself that everything about the Night Wolves was inspired by the Americans, was inspired by gangs like the Hells Angels, the Bandidos. But then over the course of time, their philosophy for sure moved away from that to something a lot more pro-Russian, a lot more patriotic.
British journalist Jack Losh, who's met the Night Wolves, the Russian motorcycle gang, now a Kremlin-funded militia in eastern Ukraine. Jack, thanks very much for telling us about him.
Thanks for your time.
Speaking of Easy Rider, the 1969 film with Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper, that film proposes the idea that freedom is about taking off on a motorcycle, going in any direction, as fast or as far as your heart tells you to go. A woman in Pakistan, Zenith Irfan, knows what this kind of freedom tastes like. She describes herself as a 21-year-old Capricorn on an epic motorcycle journey amongst the terrains of Pakistan with nothing but her free-hearted soul. So on the road throughout Pakistan for 3 weeks last summer, how much of your own country had you seen before this trip?
You know, that's a very nice question, because I initially did not know the beauty Pakistan encompasses. You know, like, I never knew Pakistan had so much beauty. All I was exposed to was people telling me how I should go to Kashmir because it's one of the heavens on earth. And when I finally made the decision to go out there and explore everything for my own self, I was literally shocked. It was more of like a shock of beauty, you can say that. Like, I was like, my God, my own country is so beautiful, you know.
Zenith, tell us why you took off on this trip. Why'd you do this?
Okay, I did it for my father. So when my father was posted in the army, and he was like at a very young age, and he was telling my mother how he wanted to go on a motorcycle journey all across the world. And he said that he couldn't do that because he was married so quickly, and that he had a job, and And my mother was pregnant with my brother at that time. And he was like, I'm already having two kids. So I'm like, you know, I'm bound with societal pressures. So which is why, and he passed away so quickly at age 34, and he left so many of his dreams. So when I was like 12 years old, and we were going through some family photographs, my mother got this crazy idea that I should pursue this dream of his and convert it as a legacy for my father. Because in our culture, we are usually bounded with certain limitations, like parents don't quickly allow their children to go and have some fun because of the culture around us. You know, it's very restrictive culture.
Not only that, I mean, what message did this trip send to young women in Pakistan?
You know, it opened a lot of perspectives for, I believe, when I told them through my photographic blog that you can ride freely, like it's your own country, you can ride freely. They were like, okay, now I guess we can send our children out there, you know. So I actually wanted everybody to travel on a motorcycle instead of a car, because the motorcycle gives you a 360-degree vision of everything that's around you. You can feel the air, the sand, and you're literally going through each and every experience, both physical, mental, and spiritual. So I encourage everybody to adopt motorcycle as a travel buddy.
Did anyone hassle you while you were out on the road?
No, nobody did. I guess it's because I was dressed as a tomboy, so like I had my whole motorcycle gear. But I remember that when I was riding till Khunjra Pass, that is the pass that connects Pakistan with China, there was this man near the security checkpost, and he was telling me how I should not be riding motorcycle and I should go back home. And I just passed a smile at him. I never got any threat.
Zenith, on your Facebook page, you hint at a reason why you also undertook this journey. You quote from the Prophet Muhammad, "Don't tell me how much educated you are. Tell me how much you traveled."
Yeah, because you see, when we are studying and when we are, you know, like in school and university, we're all the time asked to, you know, learn about something, learn concepts, definitions, but we're not asked to experience them, you know. And I believe that it's good to have education. I'm not discouraging education completely, but it's very important to travel and see things for yourself. Because I think exploring new cultures and learning stories and how people have lived earlier and continue to live so in simple environments is very important for our whole spiritual being.
Have conservative minds said to you, a young woman on motorcycle, that is not what the Prophet Muhammad meant?
No, they did not. But there was this article written on me by a local newspaper, and I went to the comments, and people were saying how I should be dressed in a burqa and I should be at home in the kitchen, and you know that I'm a shame to Muslim women. So there were those comments, but I believe it's because they don't want to open their minds. You know, they don't want to learn and they want to be in their own cocoon. They don't want to open themselves to new knowledge. And I just ignore all those comments. Like, to be honest, like, I can't just, like, ask everyone to encourage me to do this. Those who want to do it are doing it by their own choice. So it's like, for me, it's fine. I'm okay with it.
What have you learned about yourself on this trip?
I saw a different version of Zenith. I did not know that this Zenith existed within me. Mm. So for me, like, I never knew I could, like, ride for such long hours, and I never knew that I could be so spiritually liberated through these journeys. Like, I was like, I just knew how to balance the clutch, the gear, and the brakes. I just closed my eyes, and one day I just took off. And that was a very big challenge for me, and I was surprised at how much I could do. And I was surprised at how much my spiritual being was enlightened by the whole journey. So I guess this is one of the most biggest things that I've learned from my motorcycle journey, that how a single vehicle can actually change your whole life and change the way you think and look at life.
That's great. Zenith Irfan, she's been speaking with us from Lahore in Pakistan. Thanks for being with us, Zenith.
Thank you so much.
You can see images from Zenith's 3-week motorcycle journey through Pakistan there at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Haiti is a place that's seen more than its share of human hardship over the years. That's why this next story is so surprising. It's about an effort to help, not the people of Haiti, at least not directly, but rather an unloved creature found only on Hispaniola, the island that Haiti shares with the Dominican Republic. It's a kind of iguana. Amy Bracken has our story.
Pierre-Richard Sanon and Tignot Louis are scratching around in the sand near Haiti's south coast, just over the border from the Dominican Republic. They're local youth conservation workers, and they're pointing out the nesting spot of a Rhycord's iguana. The mother buries her eggs here, Sanon says, and after 3 months, the little baby iguanas emerge from the earth. The babies would be impressive looking, with gray-green armor, spikes along their backs, and menacing claws. As adults, they could grow to be 3 feet long. The Rhycord's iguana lives only on Hispaniola, and even here you're not likely to see one. It's critically endangered on the whole island, and it was thought to be extinct here in Haiti until a nest was found right here 8 years ago. Here is a stretch of hilly terrain of sand and rock in the town of Anse Pite, overlooking the Caribbean Sea. As we walk, Sanon and Louis point out hidden caves, birds, tiny iridescent lizards, and shrubby trees and cacti bearing fruit they call iguana candy. Many of these were planted by the two young men themselves as part of a reforestation program designed to protect what it turns out could be a local population of up to 500 Rhycord's iguanas. And the iguanas may face greater chance of survival thanks to this woman.
I was working as an emergency veterinarian, treating dogs and cats with Gucci collars and in the Prada bag.
That's Masani Aksime, a young Haitian-American woman from Manhattan.
And then I received an email from Ernst Rupp, who actually discovered the subpopulation of iguanas here, inviting me to work in this community where there's no electricity. And so I did.
Aksime had worked with iguanas in a zoo and had been interested in wildlife work. But she says the real draw was the opportunity to do something positive for a country she still considered home. Aksime landed a grant from a foundation and began recruiting volunteers like Louis and Sanon to patrol the area, plant trees, and speak with local residents about threats like hunting the iguana for meat and cutting trees for charcoal. She also convinced local politicians to set aside almost 20 square miles of protected iguana habitat. And she had eager collaborators in a conservation organization across the border in the Dominican Republic. Aksime says that was remarkable given how bad relations have gotten between the two neighbors.
They haven't been willing to see a border. They've been willing to see that the species actually don't have a border and they need to survive, and that's it.
In a country like Haiti, these accomplishments on behalf of a lizard are pretty impressive, but they hardly guarantee long-term success. And the challenges are huge, from unrelenting poverty and superstition about reptiles to distrust of NGOs and Haiti's political chaos. Aksime says what they need most is a national law protecting the iguana. But the government in Port-au-Prince is barely functioning, and similar dysfunction locally makes it worse. She was close to convincing the mayor of Anse Pite to push the cause in the capital, but then the mayor was ousted.
And then 4 months later, he had another. And he came in and he said, well, I don't know anything about your work. There's nothing in the office that shows that you've been working here. And I've been bringing documents and holding meetings and workshops for years.
Aksime regrouped and seems to have made progress with the town's new interim mayor. Mayor Michel-Ange Molon says he supports national protection for the iguana, but he also thinks a new law can only go so far. You have to look at the feasibility, the mayor says. If you say, I'm going to arrest anyone who cuts trees, but today there are people cutting trees to survive, how can I give them a way to survive without cutting trees? But the mayor believes Aksime's efforts have helped improve public understanding of the need to protect the iguana and its habitat. Aksime says the iguana can help restore the local forest by spreading and fertilizing seeds through its scat. She also hopes it could foster ecotourism here. And her volunteers are ready to give training and supplies to get locals to switch from chopping trees and selling charcoal to new sources of income, like beekeeping. Still, Aksime is growing weary of the challenges.
I don't know whether or not this will work, because as we've seen, many projects have been failing in Haiti.
After working in Anse Pite for the better part of 7 years, the Haitian-American veterinarian is now planning to turn the iguana project over to her protégés and hope for the best.
The only way that I think it could take hold is that if individual people have an interest in it, which I think these young people, they do. So hopefully they're stakeholders now. This is their work. I think there's a high likelihood that this could fail, but small chance that it could succeed. It's been worth a try.
For The World, Amy Bracken, Anse Pite, Haiti.
Finally today, we have an update on a story we told you about last week. Reporter Saul Gonzalez introduced us to Alex Helmy, an Iranian-American rug merchant in Los Angeles. And he was very excited by one of the economic side effects of last summer's nuclear deal with Iran, the lifting of a ban on U.S. imports of Persian rugs from Iran. Helmy said he'd already told suppliers in Iran to get a shipment ready for him.
Yes, exactly. I called already to the city of Tabriz, which I come from, and I told my weavers to pack them, start shipping them.
And a couple of days ago, Helmy got a call from customs at LAX, 40 rugs from Iran ready for pickup. So reporter Saul Gonzalez headed back to the rug store, Damoka, to hear what Helmy was feeling.
You know, it's a great day. It's a good day for all the lovers and all the hardworking people who made these rugs.
And this is a very tangible example of the trade sanctions being lifted, the nuclear sanctions against Iran. And a couple of weeks later, you get these rugs in your store.
Yes. You know, as I always said, you cannot sanction an art. You know, it is something that doesn't have anything to do with the politics. This is just, you know, people in the villages, in the homes, they make these rugs. These are not, doesn't have anything to do with the politics, doesn't have anything to do with the governments. It never did.
Alex Helmy, a very happy Iranian-American rug merchant in Los Angeles. By the way, those 40 rugs he just received from Iran, they're not cheap. According to the LA Times, the shipment's value was about $500,000. And while we're on the subject of inventory, musician Kersh Kale has an impressive inventory of recordings after almost two decades of stitching together sounds on the Asian underground scene. I saw him in Mumbai last year, a totally captivating percussionist. Kersh Kale's just released CD is called Up. We'll leave you with a taste of that. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Good to have you with us today.
PRI, Public Radio International.